Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Everyone, it's 4 o'clock in New York. If you're not scared for our democracy and the damage being done to it around the clock, brick by brick, by elected Republican officials, then you're not paying close enough attention to the knuckle-dragging, propaganda-ingesting, Trump-pacifying right of American politics. Yesterday on live television, the number two Republican elected official in the House of Representatives refused to acknowledge the legitimacy of President Joe Biden's election victory in November of 2020, which happens to be the very same election that returned him to the House of Representatives. Here's Steve Scalise undermining the very government in which he serves. Watch.
Do you think the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump?
Well, Chris, I've been very clear from the beginning. If you look at a number of states, they didn't follow their state-passed laws that governed the election for president. At least
so you rules. Think the election was stolen?
What I said is there are states that didn't follow their legislatively set rules.
Last time, I promise, do you think the election was stolen or not?
It's not just irregular. It's states that did not follow the laws set, which the Constitution says they're supposed to follow. When you see states like Georgia cleaning up some of the mess and people calling that Jim Crow law, that's a flat out lie.
Speaking of lies, Congresswoman Liz Cheney was the number three Republican in the House until she was ousted by him and others in her own party for having the audacity to tell the truth about the result of the 2020 election, responded to Steve with a crystal clear fact check and a roaring condemnation of that. She tweeted this, quote, millions of Americans have been sold a fraud that the election was stolen. Republicans have a duty to tell the American people that this is not true. Perpetuating the big lie is an attack on the core of our constitutional republic, an attack that was punctuated over the weekend when more Republican leaders, guys like Senator Chuck Grassley, flanked Donald Trump at a rally of thousands, standing right there close by his side, embracing him and his message, despite a renewed barrage of lies and dangerous disinformation peddled there, including false claims that the 2020 election was rigged. Trump also sowing doubt on the election results in Arizona, despite zero findings of fraud through three audits and even the fraudit done by the cyber ninjas. After the rally, civil war was trending on Twitter because a Trump supporter remarked on MSNBC that she thought that was where the country was heading. And it is against that backdrop that lifelong Republican Chris Krebs, once the top election cybersecurity official in Donald Trump's own administration, is issuing a warning of an anti-democratic death spiral being perpetuated by his old boss and a complicit GOP.
What we're seeing is this constant erosion of confidence in the electoral system, and it is ultimately anti-democratic, and we're frankly in a death spiral as I see it. And you know, 2 years, 4 years at the ballot box isn't good enough, and there have to be other accountability measures for those that are going to continue to proliferate these lies.
That anti-democratic death spiral, it's where we start today with some of our favorite reporters and friends. Jonathan Lemire is here, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Also joining us, Ben Rhodes, former deputy national security advisor to President Obama. And Alexi McCammon's here, political reporter for Axios. Lucky for us, all three of them are MSNBC contributors. Ben Rhodes, what happens when a democracy stops being a democracy? What do they do?
Well, it happens in slow motion. I mean, that's what people have to recognize. It's not like a light switch goes off and one day you're a democracy and the next day you're not. And we've already been going down this road of turning into something like, other than a democracy, something like an autocracy. And I think what's eating away at a lot of people right now is there's kind of two parallel stories happening in American politics. One of those stories is somewhat recognizable. A Democratic administration is trying to pass a legislative agenda. They're dealing with a lot of problems in Congress, and we're debating things like how much money should be spent on certain programs. But over here on the other side of American politics, you have a very methodical, very deliberate, very transparent effort to try to turn this country into a Donald Trumpian autocratic reality. You've got Republican state legislatures passing laws to allow them to overturn elections. You've got Republican officials almost across the board embracing a conspiracy theory that justifies undemocratic outcomes, because the big lie suggests that you shouldn't trust elections to deliver the results. You should only trust Donald Trump and his kind of handpicked Republican enablers. And we could be facing a situation where a bunch of people are living in the reality where you're debating legislative agenda items. But then in 2022, in part because of years of redistricting, the Republicans take the House of Representatives. They pass these laws at the state legislature. They now have the tools to guarantee that if it's a close election in 2024 that Donald Trump loses, they can just overturn the election, and that the House of Representatives, people like Steve Scalise, will find in favor of that when the election ultimately goes to the House. And lo and behold, we could be looking up in January of 2025 and living in a country that really is no longer a democracy, because it will be governed by someone who might have not won the election that put him in the White House. This is all happening in kind of slow motion right in front of us, Nicole, and people seem to not know how to stop it.
Well, it's all happening, but here's how you know it's BS. Here's how you know Steve Scalise knows it's total bullshit. Steve Scalise could call for every House Republican in all the states in question, in their view, to resign. Because if those states were messed up, then they're not real congressmen, are they, Alexi? I mean, why don't the Republicans have the courage of their convictions to go all the way?
It is such a terrifying time when we are seeing time and again, Nicole, that Donald Trump continues to be the leader, not just the leader of the Republican Party, but of a plurality of folks across the country poll. And again, shows the folks who consider themselves to be Republicans, who want to keep supporting not just the Donald Trumps of the world, but the Steve Scalises and the Chuck Grassleys and the others who want to continue in that mold of Donald Trump and the Trumpian politics. And to Ben's point, it's infiltrating at the state legislative level. That's something Republicans have been doing for a long time. And you know, when Trump is still dictating what the party cares about and what voters are rewarding, you're seeing how Republicans in Congress are going to continue following that trend.
It's so sad, and it would be funny if it wasn't so dangerous, if it wasn't leading us where Ben says it's leading us. Jonathan Lemire, I want to show you something Adam Schiff had to say on GMA this morning.
In the days after, when the trauma for a lot of us became even greater, I was most angry at these insurrectionists in suits and ties, these colleagues of mine who knew it was a lie, because a lot of the people attacking that Capitol believed the lie. But the people I work with, George, and I get asked about this all the time, do the Republican members really believe what they're saying? They know it's a lie. They know the election wasn't rigged, it wasn't stolen. But they just don't have the guts to speak the truth. And to me, that's unforgivable.
But so here, Jonathan Lemire, it's important to caveat that with, you know, for about 45 minutes, some of them found the guts to do it. This was Chuck Grassley's statement condemning Donald Trump's conduct. He said, Trump continued to argue that the election had been stolen, even though the courts didn't back up his claims. He belittled and harassed elected officials across the country to get his way. He encouraged his own loyal Vice President Mike Pence to take extraordinary and unconstitutional actions during the Electoral College count. My vote in this impeachment does nothing to excuse or justify those actions. There's no doubt in my mind, Trump's language was extreme, aggressive, and irresponsible. Everyone involved must take responsibility for their destructive actions that day, including the former president. Apparently, that does not extend to swaying to the warm-up music at a rally this weekend.
Yeah, and Senator Grassley, far from alone. He, of course, just announced he's going to run for re-election. So, therefore, he believes he needs Trump voters. So he's got to make nice and appear on stage with the president, receive his endorsement and all, but endorse Trump in return. But we've also heard similar statements over the last few weeks from Mike Pence, who is now criticizing the media for its an over focus on one day in January, as he put it, saying that does not undermine the 4 years of the Trump administration. We had heard similar sentiments from Nikki Haley. Also, Senator Lindsey Graham, who you might recall also from the Senate floor the day of the insurrection, said that he was done with Trump. Done. It's over. Well, not so much. He's been a frequent golf partner with the former president and says he's key to the future of the Republican Party. And the list goes on and on. And certainly there are congressmen rank and file congressmen who have also voiced this support, who know better. Senators who the same, Senators Hawley and Cruz in particular, on January 6th cast their votes to have the election be decertified, to say that they believed it was not properly done against, of course, all evidence. And this just shows that the command, the complete grip, the firm grip that Donald Trump has on the GOP, with just very, very few exceptions. And there's no sense whatsoever, as the midterms are around the corner, and even as we start to think a little bit about 2024, that's going to change. This is still his party, and it's a litmus test at this point. You need to be for the big lie if you're going to be a Republican.
It's so disgusting. And I mean, Mike Pence thinks it was just a day in January. Ben Rhodes, I hope Democrats are ready to remind Mike Pence every single day what that day in January was like. Here are the officers themselves describing that one day in January.
What we were suggested that day was like something from a medieval battle. I could feel myself losing oxygen and recall thinking to myself, this is how I'm going to die.
I was dragged from the line of officers and into the crowd. I heard someone scream, I got one.
Eventually, it was my turn in the meat grinder that was the front line. The terrorists had a wall of shields that they had stolen. I was effectively defenseless and gradually sustaining injury from the increasing pressure of the mob.
This has happened in our country like 9 months ago. They're celebrating Ashley Babbitt. I mean, what is the game plan for making sure that that is on voters' mind, that that's what Republicans are for, treating police officers like that, mutilating their bodies with flagpoles? That's what Donald Trump and Chuck Grassley and Mike Pence seem to stand with and stand for.
Well, I think here's the thing, Nicole. First of all, you have to recognize that that wasn't just one day. That was the culmination, the very natural endpoint of 4 years of attacking the media, attacking elected officials, attacking the concept of truth itself, spreading conspiracy theories, stirring people up, tapping into the worst kind of white grievance in this country. It culminated on January 6th. That couldn't have happened in a vacuum. It built up to that. And now, as soon as the kind of clock reset after January 6th, they started building up again. They're propagating the big lie. They're passing these laws at state legislatures. They're getting on the ramp again so that there'll be further political violence. And that, let's not forget what the intent of January 6th was. It was to overturn American democracy. And this has to be front and center in our politics. People sense intuitively, I think, it's like what Adam Schiff said about his colleagues. I think that there's those voters in the middle that are swinging these elections back and forth. It's not like they can't tell that this is wrong. It's not like they can't tell that there's something extreme and undemocratic about the direction that Republican politics is taking. But I think it is necessary to remind people of those excesses. Look, what I would like to see is the reforms to our democracy that make that less likely, that make it so that states can't overturn elections, that make it so that people can vote without voter suppression, making that impossible for them, and on down the line. If two Democratic senators are going to continue to block the action necessary to make those legislative changes, then there has to be an argument every election until we do resolve these issues that our democracy itself is on the ballot and that everything else you care about is going to be chucked overboard if we are governed by a cabal of people who have loyalty to nothing higher than Donald J. Trump. These are the stakes every election, so long as we haven't fixed the structures, these are the stakes every election going forward.
I guess the only thing I would push back on is I don't think it was the culmination, Ben Rhodes, and I don't think you think it was the culmination. I think it was the halftime show. I think the culmination will be something far more dangerous because the laws have changed. It has been rigged. In Georgia, the voter suppression law was so offensive that Major League Baseball, which is loath to get involved in politics, moved the game. And we've stopped talking about it. It was so bad. And it is the law of the land. And the guy that made sure Donald Trump didn't find his 11,740 votes, Brad Raffensperger, no hero, but he did the right thing on that day, is being primaried by someone even scarier. So I think it's misleading to even describe January 6th as a culmination. What is sort of the state of alarm? And what is the plan for making sure that slide toward voter suppression, toward rigging the count, toward voter nullification that happened in Georgia doesn't happen everywhere?
Well, first of all, you're right. Thank you for correcting me. Because the reality, too, is that they hit a roadblock and then they gave themselves the tools to get around the roadblock next time, which is states can overturn the results of elections instead of those being certified. And here's the other reality, too, Nicole. The Donald Trump who could take office in January 2025 will be much more authoritarian and surrounded by much more autocratic idiocy than even when he came in 2017 and he wanted to rely on some established Republicans and generals. We would be starting the clock from a much more authoritarian place in January of 2025. I think what you need, if you look at the coordinated effort that Republicans have to be introducing kind of mirror image voter suppression laws at the state level, to be introducing kind of mirror image capacity to overturn the election, to frankly be parroting these conspiracy theories, I think if you continue to have the obstruction to filibuster reform that could allow you to solve this at the federal level, I think you're going to need a similar level of grassroots state legislative across the country imperative of educating voters about the extremist threat to democracy itself, of registering people, of activating people, of putting the biggest possible tent over the coalition of people that oppose this kind of autocracy. What I've seen in other countries is it takes everybody getting together who believes in democracy, even if they might disagree about a lot of other things, working this as if the future of democracy itself depends on it, because it does.
Absolutely. It doesn't matter what your tax rate is if you're in jail. Alexei, I want to talk about something that may or may not be on the radar of our viewers, but Donald Trump makes videos for lots of stuff. He goes to stuff. He goes to wrestling matches. He, I think he's like a wedding crasher from that movie. But he made a video for someone this weekend, and I'm not going to play it, but he made a happy birthday video to Ashley Babbitt, who was fatally shot during the insurrection. And Sergeant Gunnell, who's appeared on the show a couple times, had this to say. Oh, my God, there is no bottom. He doesn't realize she died because of him, but he wants an investigation. How many layers after layers she breached to get to the chamber? The problem is the impact of disinformation and propaganda and Donald Trump is that up is down and down is up. And I wonder if you've heard from any Republicans today who are uncomfortable with Donald Trump's elevation and celebration of the martyrdom of Ashley Babbitt.
I personally have not. But I think the larger point that you're getting at and that Ben's getting at and that Jonathan Lemire is getting at and that we're all talking about is that it might not be a culmination of the Trump politics, but we're seeing the clear evolution of the Trumpian political mindset take hold of folks in this country and of the Republican Party. It's fitting that we have Donald Trump claiming the big lie and the election was stolen from him in Iowa. When you all remember well, during the 2016 election, he started calling, you know, for voter fraud and election fraud when Ted Cruz won the Iowa caucuses instead of him. He then went on to claim that the election was rigged in some capacity, even though he won it in 2016, because he was unhappy about the margin by which he lost to Hillary Clinton in the popular vote. The difference, even though Trump has been claiming this big lie, is we have a name for it now, but Republicans up and down the ballot, up and down the party around the country are now getting in line because Donald Trump is the establishment of the Republican Party now. He went from being the anti-establishment candidate in 2016 to now redefining the party based on his personal politics and grievances and conspiracy theories. And Trumpism is the establishment of the party. And the folks who disagree with him are becoming quieter and fewer in number because that anti-establishment persona as a Republican is not something that's being rewarded politically.
I mean, it's a perfect political analysis, but it makes me feel physically ill hearing you articulate it. Jonathan Lemire, I want to read you something about this reality that Philip Bump writes. Trump continues to hold a position of influence within the Republican Party and seems likely, if not certain, to run again for president in 2024. His embrace of political violence before the 2016 election was noted and noteworthy, but now it's metastasized. Trump is publicly defending and helping reframe the reputation of a woman who is part of an effort to engage in political violence on his behalf. By extension, he's defending and reframing the violence itself. What happens next? What could go wrong?
Yeah, this is a dangerous moment, Nicole. And it didn't happen right away, the Ashley Babbitt story. We saw that footage within hours of the incident on January 6th. And it took some weeks and then even some months before she almost became a martyr on some elements of the right, that they embraced her image as doing a patriot who was doing the right thing, who was unjustly killed. None of that is true. She was deeply involved in conspiracy theories and was trying to break in through the chamber where she was just steps away from important members of Congress. And if she had breached it, who knows how many others would have been right behind her. But Trump in particular has seized upon this, tweeted, has put out emailed statements about it, and now put together this video. And despite this behavior that frankly has largely been ignored by the mainstream media, and therefore allowing Republicans to kind of skate past it without having to answer for it, we've seen Trump's stock sort of rise. And I want to point something out. There's a Pew poll last week that gained a lot of attention because it showed that Trump was still the preferred candidate of 40-odd percent of Republicans. He was the plurality. He was the favorite. But it also showed there were a lot of Republicans who didn't want him to be the nominee in 2024. But that poll had another number, too, that leaped out at me, that between January and the insurrection and now, more than 10% of additional 10% of Republicans from 50 to 60% thought that Trump should play a significant role in the party politics going forward, that whether he runs or not, he should be one of the faces of the GOP. Well, 10% increase since January, that shows the effectiveness of his and other Republicans' efforts to whitewash and downplay the insurrection. That's now become just another political moment they're trying to frame, as opposed to one of the darkest days in our nation's history. And it shows that at least among Republicans, it's working. And that's really dangerous going forward.
Ben Rhodes, it's not even clear that the celebration and elevation of Ashley Babbitt is original material. Vladimir Putin also made the same points. How interwoven is Putin's message about Babbitt and Donald Trump's?
Well, what we've seen in the past is that these are completely overlapping narratives. Sometimes they originate in Russia and they're kind of turbocharged here. Sometimes they originate here and then the Russians come in and juice the social media algorithm to get those narratives, get them to have more legs. The reality is they've constructed like an information feedback loop with their supporters, with that Trump base, in which you slot in any number of antagonists. There's always like an evil other that we're against. And usually, frankly, it's black or brown. And then you slot in some kind of martyr figure. And all this is to keep people engaged and keep them exercised. But the reality is what's been shifting is just how far they're willing to go. And now we're celebrating someone who is literally a part of an effort to end American democracy. And in that context, it just disappears. As long as you continue to play this tapping into grievance and this stirring people up and tugging on their emotions, it doesn't matter what the context is. It doesn't matter what she was a part of. It doesn't matter how divorced from the truth it is. People are just kind of living inside of this movement that has Donald Trump at the forefront of it. And the entire Republican Party, with a couple of exceptions, is just going along with that. And by the way, if they didn't go along with it, it couldn't happen. If people began to call this out and say this is too dangerous, you wouldn't be able to see that kind of creep back up in Trump's numbers. When you have people that have credibility, Chuck Grassley has people who've known Chuck Grassley. He's been in their lives for decades in Iowa politics. When they see him going along with this, it makes them feel like it's okay for them to go along with it, even though there's a part of them probably knows that it's wrong. And so the responsibility is not just on Trump. It's on all of these Republicans who continue to make the choice to go along with it.
I mean, one of the most important points, Trump is the spark, but the Republicans are the oxygen. Without them, there is no slide toward autocracy. Jonathan Lemire, Alexi McCammon, thank you for starting us off. I know it was grim, but it was important. Ben Rhodes is sticking around. When we come back, the January 6th Select Committee threatening criminal referrals now to those defying subpoenas to testify before them. Another big week coming up in the showdown between Congress and Donald Trump's inner circle. Could their GOP colleagues be next in that fight to get to the bottom of what happened that day? Plus, executives at Facebook took some time over the weekend to clean up some of the mess after we learned from last week's whistleblower testimony. But apparently, based on news reports, it didn't go very well. An evasive non-answer to whether Facebook helped spread pro-insurrection voices ahead of January 6th. That reporting's coming up. And later in the show, the GOP battle cry for more election audits in states they won, signaling an all-out assault to undermine confidence in all election results moving forward. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at msnbc.com/win. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place every day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning in your inbox, you'll find expert analysis, video highlights of your favorite shows.
Running for re-election is when you actually get your report card from the American people.
Previews from our podcasts and documentaries, as well as written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves. Understand today's news. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at msnbc.com.
I think if it gets to a point where we realize they're stonewalling or they're not serious, there's contempt things you can file. You can do it through Congress. You can do it through the DOJ, criminal contempt. I think that's our leaning, is to say criminal contempt. This is so serious of a moment that we have to get the answers. Look, if you're running away, if this was literally nothing on January 6th, if it was frankly Antifa, which keep in mind, they're still out there saying, they should probably want to come in and testify. If they're hiding something, I can understand why they're going to be stonewalling.
Spitting truth there, Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger saying that the January 6th Select Committee he serves on is prepared to ask the Justice Department to prosecute the Trump aides who defy their subpoenas, perhaps setting the stage for a major legal battle that could shape the future of the January 6th investigation. And with it, one of the big questions in American politics right now, will there be any accountability anywhere for those who incited a deadly insurrection? Joining us now, Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy of Illinois, member of the House Oversight and of the Intelligence Committee. Congressman, thank you so much for being with us. So many of these stories sort of coming to a head between the Judiciary Committee report and the January 6th work. I wonder if I could just get your views on what Congressman Kinzinger is saying there, that they're preferred to refer contempt.
He's right, Nicole. I think that anybody who refuses to comply with a valid subpoena is subject to jail time and fines under a criminal statute called 2 U.S.C. Section 192. And it's very clear that this particular statute authorizes the DOJ to go after any witness, such as Steve Bannon, for instance, who refuses to come before the committee. And unlike during the Trump years when we couldn't use that statute because the Trump administration wouldn't enforce it, I think this time around the Biden administration, I'm hopeful, would be willing to enforce it.
When you hear Steve Scalise refuse to acknowledge the legitimacy of President Joe Biden in an election that returned him to the Congress, and you don't hear Steve Scalise suggest that every House Republican who was returned on the same ballots they now allege were fraudulent and phony or not valid. What do you make of the fact that so many Republicans buy what Steve Scalise is selling?
It's deeply disturbing. And I know Minority Whip Scalise knows what he's doing. He's trying to have his cake and eat it, too. On the one hand, you're absolutely right. Those Republicans that were elected in a lot of these states that they contested are a vital part of his, minority. And he's obviously trying to create a majority with them. But at the same time, he wants to question the election. And that is part of this disturbing narrative that the GOP is weaving. And unfortunately, it's gaining traction within the party.
What do we do?
Well, I think we have to do the right thing, first of all. I think that's why the Select Committee has to expose the truth. I will say that a recent poll did show that still there's a majority of Americans who want to know what the truth is of January 6th. I think we're just racing against the clock, Nicole, because we have to make sure that we get the truth out on the table in the form of documents and testimony, certainly during this Congress. I think, secondly, we obviously have to hold accountable those Republicans who would have subscribed to the notion of the big lie that Donald Trump actually won the election and Joe Biden did not. And secondly, that Donald Trump had nothing to do with January 6th, but rather Antifa did. And that the people, the insurrectionists who appeared, were mere tourists, as some of my colleagues have said. Those are kooky ideas. And I think that we have to make sure that we message on them properly and hold those people who would believe in them to account in the upcoming elections.
I want to follow up with you after I show you something that Congressman Raskin said about enforcing the subpoenas, because it's my sense that folks like Steve Bannon just don't think that Congress is serious. For when you look at how much Trump got away with and his inner circle never held accountable for anything, it makes sense that they would try what they were trying. I want to show you what Congressman Raskin said and ask if you think that the January 6th investigation will be sort of a dividing line.
There was an attack on the U.S. government, on the U.S. Congress. More than 140 of our officers were wounded or injured in this violent insurrection, which delayed the counting of presidential electoral votes for the first time in American history. So it could not be a graver issue. And none of these people have any arguments. Steve Bannon had been fired from the executive branch of government back in 2017. He wasn't working for the executive branch. So even if you assume hypothetically that Donald Trump has some kind of executive privilege, which is extremely dubious in itself, how could that extend to Steve Bannon? So he's completely exposed. Remember, Susan McDougal spent 18 months in jail because she refused to participate in the Whitewater investigation when she was under subpoena. Does the law only apply against Democrats? I don't think so. The law applies to everybody, including former presidents and including friends of former presidents who are facilitating the incitement of violent insurrection against the union.
And Congressman Steve Bannon, I believe, was also charged with crimes for which he was pardoned by Donald Trump. So I wonder if you're confident that this will be where the rubber meets the road, if the subpoenas for Steve Bannon should be enforced, and if not, that he'll be referred for criminal contempt.
I respectfully believe they should be. They must be. And I think that the referral to the DOJ and the U.S. Attorney's Office will help to move the process much more swiftly along than any process that we used during the Trump administration years. I'd just like to piggyback off of something that Congressman Raskin said as well, which is that I think that in this particular case, I still believe the vast majority of the American people want to know the truth of what happened that day. And to that end, I think that the fact that we do have Republicans on the special committee is going to help us in bolstering the case for enforcing these subpoenas and getting at that truth and exposing it. It's that important.
I agree. I mean, I think when people see Congressman Kinzinger and then someone named Cheney on the committee, it certainly has its bipartisan nature conveyed. Congressman, thank you so much for spending some time with us on a holiday. We're grateful. Facebook is trying to clean up a very, very no good, bad week the company had last week in Washington. If you had trouble following the social media giant's responses, you're not alone. Our next guest says that is exactly what Facebook intended. Our friend Steve Schmidt on that topic is next.
Did the algorithms that are in place amplify pro-insurrection voices ahead of January 6th? Yes or no?
Look, given we have thousands of algorithms and you have millions of people using this, I can't give you a yes or no answer to the individual personalized feeds that each person uses. Of course, January the 6th, the responsibility for that is for the people who broke the law, who inflicted the violence, who aided and abetted them, who encouraged them.
Three times in that interview with Dan Abash yesterday, Facebook Vice President for Global Affairs, a guy named Nick Clegg, dodged that question from Dan Abash over the company's responsibility in allowing disinformation to spread online ahead of the Capitol insurrection. It's after whistleblower Frances Haugen's searing Senate testimony last week. She testified that Facebook knowingly fuels division for profit with algorithms that rank content based on engagement and extreme reaction from their users. Clegg's interview adds to Facebook's very messy week of attempted damage control and complete deflection. It included a cleanup attempt by an executive named Monica Bickert, that left people, most people, wanting more straight answers. Our friend Steve Schmidt watched it, provided his analysis, and says this, quote, she, Monica, is skilled at making declarative assertions that sound credible, real, believable, responsible at first blush. Her confidence and assertiveness quickly pulled the interview into a discussion about Facebook process. The quagmire that results is purposeful. The answers are supposed to be stultifying, boring, inaccessible, and incomprehensible. And they were. Joining us now is former Republican strategist Steve Schmidt. It was an incredible tweet thread. It in part inspired an incredible column by Kara Swisher. But Nick Clegg maybe missed it. He didn't do any better yesterday.
No, look, Nicole, there's only three types of questions that will ever be asked of a person. There are I know questions, I think questions, and I feel questions. You saw Nick Clegg get a classic I know question. Yes or no, as Dana Bash put it, direct question. He knows what the answer is, but he can't answer it directly. So he gets into a territory, well, I think, I don't know. We feel, and all of the Facebook spokespeople who are on television, what struck me is the immediacy with which they try to strike a connection with the audience. I was a former prosecutor, don't you understand? I prosecuted cases and protected children. Nick Clegg talking about in platitudes. Well, we're all on this journey together, this journey of discovery. And of course, it's all nonsense. This is a trillion-dollar company that was conjured in the dorm room of an awkward teen trying to rate hot girls that is metastasized into this monster that afflicts our children and their self-esteem, is a great danger not just to American democracy, but to democracy globally. And it is the information superhighway of misinformation, disinformation that has literally imprisoned people algorithmically as it constructs impenetrable walls that have the effect in the end of forcing submission in these people of their intellectual agency, their sovereignty, as they give themselves over to these reinforcing self-perpetuating conspiracy theories delivered by Facebook. So we have an enormous issue in America and globally about what to do with Mr. Zuckerberg's creation. But it's a serious issue. And what struck me was not since really the cigarette companies have we seen a galactic level of disingenuousness that parallels what we saw last week with the Facebook executives on TV through the weekend. And I suppose now that they've stopped apologizing, that it's a good thing because it's all out on the table. And I think that it'll be interesting to see how this plays out over the next couple of months.
And what seems to be so devastating, I read the New York Times story about some of the internal strife, is that the workforce now knows that they knew. The company knew what it was doing. They knew they were empowering the worst, the grossest, the most dangerous, the most vehement, the most bogus, passion-stirring disinformation. They knew. And so in that way, as a corporate crisis corporation kind of story, it is in line with tobacco or the ignition story. I mean, as a corporation that does grave harm and knew the whole time, they don't often survive, do they?
Well, they're usually profoundly affected, but we've never seen a trillion-dollar company before. Facebook, I think you could think accurately about as less a company and more as a powerful non-state actor. This is a company that in all the history of the world, nothing quite like it has ever existed before. And at this moment as a society, the American society, as we think about this and try to get our arms around it at the advent of the age of artificial intelligence, where there will be more innovation over the next 20 years than there was over the last 20 years, in this age of rapid technological transition, Facebook opens the door to a bevy of issues and questions that a society, as parents, we have to reckon with, particularly in one that values free speech. Because This cannot be the instrument in the vehicle of our poisoning. Monica Bicker was asked a question, and the question was, does Facebook basically exist to make profit on this? And she said, no, it doesn't. But that's not the point. The point is what the outcome is. And the outcome is we have a company that has obliterated more than any other the line that exists between the truth and the lie. And that's the ultimate danger to democracy, because democracies require the ability to tell the difference between the lie and the truth. Without the truth, there's no accountability. With the lie, there can be great abuses in the name of authority. So it is a dangerous company. It is not understood by policymakers, broadly speaking, and it is operating disingenuously in the public space, to say the least.
Steve Schmidt, thank you for spending some time with us on your thoughts on this, which leapt out at me at the time. I want to just update our viewers, though. The whistleblower has accepted an invitation to brief the Facebook Oversight Board. That's separate from Mr. Zuckerberg, about what she has learned while working there. Facebook has lied to the board repeatedly, and I am looking forward to sharing the truth with them. We will stay on it. Next for us, fake furs, missing gift bags. You guessed it, all part of the shadiness of a Trump administration foreign trip. More reporting on just how much of a mess the last administration really was in this department next.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Go beyond the what to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
There is jaw-dropping new reporting in the New York Times today detailing what appears to be a culture of corruption and incompetence surrounding what some Trump officials did and did not do with expensive gifts from and for foreign leaders. It goes farther than that. Quote, the State Department's inspector general is investigating allegations that Trump's political appointees walked off with gift bags worth thousands of dollars that were meant for foreign leaders at the Group of Seven summit planned for Camp David in 2020, which was canceled because of the coronavirus pandemic. The bags contained dozens of items purchased with government funds, including leather portfolios, pewter trays, and marble trinket boxes emblazoned with the presidential seal or the signatures of Trump and Melania. Joining our conversation, the reporter on that new reporting, Mike Schmidt. Ben Rhodes is back. Mike, tell us about the Saudi furs. That seems to be some of the most salacious and juicy reporting in here.
So when Donald Trump went to Saudi Arabia in May of 2017, if you remember, there was that thing with the orb. They really lavished Trump with gifts, at least they appeared to. When they got back, a White House lawyer determined that one or two or three of the gifts might violate the Endangered Species Act because it said it was came from a white tiger and it came from cheetah fur. And if you are in possession of items like that, you're violating the law. But the Trump White House held on to these items for 3.5 more years. They showed up at the General Services Administration on the last day of the Trump administration. In response to our questions, U.S. Fish and Wildlife took possession of them over the summer because they are the folks that deal with endangered species products. And when Fish and Wildlife looked at these furs and examined them and tested them, they determined that they had been dyed to look like white tigers and cheetahs, and they were fakes.
Ben, I know you write about your Saudi trip in your book. I want to read you some more of Mike's reporting about this Saudi trip. State Department disclosed a list of 82 gifts from the Saudis to Trump administration officials on the May 2017 trip in response to a Freedom of Information Act request filed shortly after Trump returned home. The gifts range from ordinary ones like sandals and scarves to expensive ones like these furs Mike's talking about and daggers. Nine of the most expensive presents, the three furs, three swords, and three daggers, were sent to the White House gift unit to be assessed and appraised but never appeared on any of the Trump State Department's legally required annual filings for foreign gifts, according to a review of government documents. As Mike is saying, it wasn't until January 19, 2021 that they ended up in the right place. I worked in the White House. You worked in administration. You worked in a White House. You cannot have a reporter like Mike buy you a soda. You pay for everything. Foreign gifts are a higher level experience. Talk about yours.
Well, Nicole, my first trip to Saudi Arabia in 2009, I was traveling with President Obama, and we were staying at a compound that belonged to then King Abdullah. And when I got to my room, there was a suitcase right inside the door. And I opened the suitcase, and it was full of jewels, full of different kind of jewelry, precious stones. And I was new to government, and I thought, oh my gosh, are these people trying to, you know, bribe me, gain revenge on me? Then I find that every single member of our traveling party had gotten a similar suitcase full of jewels. And the Obamas, of course, was the most lavish. And you immediately learn, oh, you don't even touch those. They just get taken by the State Department protocol people traveling. And that was the routine you get accustomed to in government, whether it's President Obama on down, you get gifts where you go and you never keep those gifts for a moment. You just hand those to the protocol people and they just deal with it and it gets accounted. And then there's an option for you to buy the gifts at the price that they cost, but nobody ever takes that option. I think a lot of us were suspicious about whether the Trump people were going to follow those rules, particularly when you have people like the Saudis who like to lavish gifts on visitors. And sometimes those can be very public displays of gifts. But I don't know what happens when Jared Kushner goes over to see Mohammed bin Salman for a kind of private meeting. I think there's probably a lot we don't know here.
Mike, I mean, speak to that. What do we still not know? And to Ben's point, were there suitcases of jewels given to the Trumps that we don't know about? Did they get different kinds of gifts? Were they fur people and the Saudis knew that? Or explain who gets what?
Well, the problem, as we write about in the story, is that the Trump administration did not follow a lot of the rules, laws, and procedures around gifts. And these are things that are designed to ensure that there's not a perception of impropriety, that things look like they're done above board. And the problem that's sort of the heart of this is the fact that the Trump administration never properly filed these gifts and disclosed who got them, how much they were worth, and what was done with them. So because of that, I cannot answer your question about the depth and breadth of the gifts that they received because they didn't follow the rules. They didn't follow the basics of government. And I understand that compared to a lot of other things, most people may think this is not a big deal and such. But these are sort of the basic rudimentary parts of government that we often do not pay a lot of attention to that under the Trump administration, things that were on autopilot in previous administrations went off the rails.
I think missing gifts from foreign leaders is pretty essential to who is pulling the strings, Ben Rhodes. What is the bigger scandal for the Saudis, that the furs may or may not have been real, or that Trump had them somewhere undisclosed for 3 years and then turned them over?
I mean, for the Saudis, it's probably that they may or may not be real. These are people that are sitting on $1 trillion sovereign wealth fund. I mean, and to Mike's point, I think the reason this is actually a big deal is it's yet another reminder that norms in particular are not self-executing.
Right.
And if you have people that just ignore the norms, then it opens the door wide open to all manner of corruption. You know, if they're not accounting for the fake tiger furs, do you think that they're accounting for other ways in which foreign governments may have lavished resources on them? What happened on trips that weren't as high profile as a presidential trip? Because what's at stake really is the integrity of American government and American foreign policy and whether or not it's bought and paid for by people that have good gifts, whether they're tacky or not, whether they're illegal or not here, you know?
It's crazy, crazy, crazy piece of reporting. Mike Schmidt and Ben Rhodes, thank you so much for spending some time with us on it. The next hour of Deadline White House starts after a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We're just getting started.
I think we not only came close to a full constitutional crisis, I think we're still in it.
Yeah. Mm.
And that gives me absolutely no satisfaction in saying this, because I think we're at a very dangerous, continuing, high-level attack on the legitimacy of our government and the election of our president. And obviously, our former president is not only behind it, he incited it, he encouraged it, and he continues to do so. Yeah. And you have leaders of the Republican Party who have willingly gone along as though they're members of a cult, not a political party, but a cult. And their continuing attacks on the election, their refusal to say, you know what, we've counted these votes, it's over, we're going to move on, has sown so much doubt. And then you combine it with the disinformation network known as Facebook, and you've got a volatile mix. So, yeah, we are still in the midst of a concerted, well-funded effort to undermine American democracy.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York. The woman who ran against Donald Trump with a bleak warning for all of us. Our country, our democracy is in peril due to the ex-president and his party marching along willfully away from the free and fair elections America has always prided itself on and toward the road of authoritarianism, something totally different for most of us. We saw it in the halls of Congress, Republicans saying and doing everything all the time just to stay on Trump's good side, no matter what the truth actually was. Well, it's bigger now, right? The practice has extended. It's actually gone local, state and local GOP officials. When given the choice now between Trump, who lost bigly in the American democracy, what do you think? They choose the twice impeached ex-president, all out of fear of losing, I don't know what, their positions of power in his orbit. Take a look at what's going on in Texas. Keep in mind, it's a state Donald Trump won by 6 points. He's right now pressuring officials in Texas to launch audits of that state's election result. Axios reports this, quote, former President Trump threatened Republican Texas Speaker of the House, Dade Phelan, with political consequences if a bill allowing for more audits of the 2020 election doesn't come up for a vote soon. Axios adds this, quote, when the election audit bill passed in the Senate last week, one Republican, Amarillo Senator Kel Seliger, voted against it. Trump subsequently endorsed one of Seliger's primary challengers. Trump said that if the bill doesn't pass soon, he would, quote, look forward to seeing Phelan in the Texas primary. This test of loyalty to a loser, a former president, and his big lies is metastasizing. Insider reporting on a pressure campaign in Florida, another state, Trump won. Quote, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida and top conservative lawmakers in Tallahassee are being pushed and members of their own party to audit the 2020 election result, despite former President Trump's relatively comfortable win in the state last year. In late September, Lake County Republicans, based in a fast-growing GOP-leaning jurisdiction near Orlando, unanimously approved 5 resolutions to send to every Florida state lawmaker in calling for a full audit of the election results. The fact that Republicans are now calling for reviews of election results where Trump won in places that they bragged about for being so good, places like Florida, is a clear sign. And we should all pay attention to it. This isn't about 2020 anymore, okay? It's about 2022. It's about 2024. And everything that comes next, everything. It's all about undermining people's confidence in every election from this point forward. And as Secretary Clinton said, undermining American democracy. The Republican-led slow-motion coup happening before our very eyes is where we start this hour with some of our favorite reporters in France. Aaron Haynes is here, editor-at-large for the 19th. Also joining us, Charlie Sykes, editor-at-large of The Bulwark. And Frank Figluzzi's back, former FBI assistant director for counterintelligence, host of the Bureau podcast, all 3 MSNBC contributors. I'm going to start with Bill Maher, Charlie. Let me show you what he said. Got a lot of attention Friday night.
Some presidents spend their post-presidency building homes for the poor or raising money for charity or painting their toes. Trump has spent his figuring out how to pull off the coup he couldn't pull off last time. Here's the easiest 3 predictions in the world. Trump will run in 2024. He will get the Republican nomination, and whatever happens on election night, the next day he will announce that he won. I've been saying ever since he lost, he's like a shark that's not gone, just gone out to sea. But actually, he's been quietly eating people this whole time. And by eating people, I mean he's been methodically purging the Republican Party of anyone who voted for his impeachment or doesn't agree that he's the rightful leader of the Seven Kingdoms. Yes, we're going to need a bigger boat.
It's brilliant. It needed to be said. And I fear that, let's see, Charlie, on all three, he's probably correct.
Yeah, he's not wrong. Whatever you think about Bill Maher, I mean, that was scary stuff. But I agree with every one of his predictions. Look, you know, somebody asked me the other day, what would happen if you had a rerun of the presidential election, the Biden-Trump election in 2024, and Biden wins Wisconsin again by 20,000 votes? What would happen? Do you think that the next time around, a Republican-dominated legislature and a Republican governor might actually do the unthinkable and overturn the result? And I am not confident whatsoever that they would not do that. So, I mean, you know, when you say this is about 2024, you're exactly right. What is the point of the audits other than to discredit the election system, to plant doubt? And you're seeing this from the grassroots, but you're seeing it from the top. You have a leadership problem. You have a followership problem. Donald Trump goes to Iowa, and instead of talking about substantive issues that affect the American people, he is doubling down, tripling down, quadrupling down on the big lie. And nobody is pushing back against him. So what's interesting is you have a lot of cynical Republicans who've gone along with the audit because why not? You don't want to get the tweets. But they're being pushed by the crazies all the time to push it further and further and further. And here in Wisconsin, it's playing out that way, where basically the fever swamps are pushing even the Republicans who've gone along with this, go further, more extreme, threaten local officials with jail. You wonder where we're going to be in 2024, and I think it's going to be a very scary place.
Well, right, of course. And Aaron, it's not an analogy I use loosely or disrespectfully, but the addiction to Trump can't be cured by enabling more heinous Trump. So all the enablers have been proven wrong. They've all been humiliated, from H.R. McMaster and Dina Powell and Secretary Mattis on foreign policy, from, General Milley's barely going to get out with his reputation intact, to every politician that sort of, you know, nodded and went along with this gambit. They have all been shamed out of their morals, I guess intimidated out of their convictions. But now what they've greenlit is the destruction of our democracy. If people don't believe in election results, do we live in a democracy?
And that is exactly the question, right? Because we know that the big lie didn't succeed this time in getting President Trump reelected. Remember, in 2016, he was pushing the big lie, but he won that election. And so, you didn't get the metastasization of the big lie in the way that we see it in 2020. But the big lie is succeeding in undermining our democracy, just as you outlined, Nicole. I mean, the former president is continuing to wield the big lie in the GOP because despite being out of office, he's very much in power in the Republican Party. And he's not even the only one that needs to carry this message. I mean, it's why you have the House Minority Whip Steve Scalise dodging Chris Wallace on the very simple question, do you think the election was stolen from Donald Trump? I mean, it's why a seven-term senator, Senator Chuck Grassley, is willing to share a stage with the former president after denouncing the January 6th election. I mean, just to your point, this was not just about the last election. It's about the future of elections. Questioning results in the places that he's won is meant to erode people's confidence in the election. And you know, this is something that we have to reject as a country, because regardless of our politics, this threatens the very foundations of what our country claims to be about and the story that we tell the world about who we are. And so that's why this matters and why we have to continue to talk about this and confront this.
Well, I mean, and I guess if we're being honest, Frank Figluzzi, this is who we are. We are auditing. We're still auditing thrice audited election results, regardless of whether Trump won or lost in, what is it, October of 2021. That is who we are. And if you're our friend, we're mortified. We're sorry. If you're our enemy, we're scared, too. But here's what we're doing. In Boise, Idaho election officials reject fraud claims after more recounts. AJC, no fraud. Georgia audit confirms the authenticity of the absentee ballots. Arizona Mirror, Arizona audit, unsubstantiated claim. I mean, the fraud audit results don't seem to matter either, because even the fraud audit done by the Stop the Steal guy, Cyber Ninjas, found no fraud. Bill Barr found no fraud. Lifelong Republican Chris Krebs found no fraud. There is no fraud. So what is happening? What are our adversaries watching us do to ourselves?
Sadly, there are national security repercussions to this. I know we're focused on things like, oh, the future of our democracy, but we also have to tie in and weave into this narrative the fact that we have enemies in the world who are watching this very, very closely, and they're looking at us almost now like a third world nation that needs observers to come in to watch the election process. They're going to find us very vulnerable. We're at a point now, still with 15 states with less than half of their population vaccinated. We're looking at a select committee who's trying, but largely being ignored, to subpoena people to testify and provide evidence about an insurrection. And now we are questioning even the states and or counties where the former president actually won. This is a strategy, clearly, as Charlie said, to try and get us to lose our faith in our own election system. Where does this lead? Vulnerability and violence. Think about this. If the thought of Trump having had the election stolen from him got people to actually stop the peaceful transition of power, try to stop it on January 6th with violence, imagine if now various states decide, you know what, we've got so many anomalies in our systems, we can't trust our own ballots this next election. That is a recipe for chaos. And the kind of muscle memory that's required to keep our democracy going, where it's instinctive that we certify an election, we understand the results, and we move on. If that's destroyed, we are in chaos.
Let me show you some of Chris Krebs' interview, Charlie Sykes, about what I think Frank is describing is the self-fulfilling, self-perpetuating cycle that we are already in.
They're afraid to speak up because they're afraid the former president is going to try to primary them. And then the other piece is that they've activated and lost control of their voting base, the people that are going to put them in power. And they know that if they go against the former president, that not only will he speak out against them, but they're going to, you know, they're going to start seeing people show up at their town halls. I mean, you've actually seen Republican members of Congress stop holding town halls because they've overactivated their base and it's gotten out of control. So, again, this is a death spiral. They've lost control and they don't have the ability to rein it back in.
So, Charlie, this is how old I am and how long ago I worked on campaigns. It used to be political death to be weak. But now weakness is their brand. The Republicans are so weak that Steve Scalise couldn't go on TV and say, oh, my Republican colleagues who were sent back on the same piece of paper, right, the paper ballot that Trump was on, they're here justifiably, but the top line for president was fraudulent. He couldn't even say that Joe Biden won in the same legitimate, thrice audited in many instances, ballots that his House Republican colleagues won on. It's an illogical argument. It suggests exactly what Chris Krebs says it suggests. They're hostages of their own voters, but they have created the extremism and the radicalization of their own base.
Yes, exactly. They have. And it is, look, these leaders are so weak that they're afraid to tell their own followers the truth. That is a sign of weakness. But Chris Krebs is absolutely right. What's happened is all of this has gotten totally out of control. It's like they thought we could have a control burn, we could have a control campfire. And instead, you have this raging conflagration and they don't know what to do except to go along with it. And it is dangerous. And to Frank's point, look, we have had surveys showing a majority of Trump voters would support secession. There's irresponsible, reckless talk of civil war. This is a moment at which Americans are increasingly looking at one another with distrust, with loathing, with fear. There's a possibility we will pull apart. And what does Donald Trump do? He figures that this is exactly the chaos that he needs to launch his revenge tour, and he's pouring kerosene on it. So it is a dangerous moment that's becoming more dangerous, especially because there are Republicans who are looking on saying, we could push back against this, we could resist this, we could tell the truth, but they're not going to do it. So yes, we are in this very dangerous spiral, and Chris Krebs is a professional. He knows how dangerous it is, and I'm glad that he's sounding the alarm.
I don't like ever putting the cleanup on one of the two parties. This is about the collapse of the Republican Party, about it descending into not just dysfunction, but something that is actually hurting the country, the move away from our democratic norms. That stipulated, Aaron Haynes, one of the remedies is to protect the right to vote, the access to the polls, and to protect who does the counting. A lot of these suppression laws have nullification measures in them. What is your understanding of the current state of a carve out for federal voting rights legislation?
Well, you know, Chris Krebs also talked about in that interview, you know, the accountability measures being needed to, you know, to counteract the big lie. And you know, it's unclear kind of who would hold these people accountable that continue to perpetuate this, or kind of what accountability would look like. But at least one form of accountability could be, just to your point, that the voting rights legislation that is pending in Congress, and that is getting kind of a renewed look right now in the midst of everything else that, that Congress is trying to get done in a very divided political climate. But it is unclear whether or not that legislation is going to pass. But that legislation includes the kind of stopgap measures that might counteract a lot of what we are continuing to see either already enacted in states, or what you will see state legislatures continuing to try to enact, you know, through the rest of this year, at the beginning of next year, when these legislatures reconvene. So, you know, this is something that a lot of the voters who will be impacted by that voter suppression, that's what they voted for. They voted for, you know, federal action to protect them at the ballot box, because they what they tell me is that they did their jobs in November, and they're looking for the people that they helped to get elected to do their job now in terms of protecting voting rights. I mean, you've got the Supreme Court potentially taking up voting rights soon as well, but no indication that they may not continue to erode the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And so really, you know, all eyes are increasingly turning to Congress and what they will be able to do, what, you know, final versions of that legislation will look like, and if it can even be passed. You know, this summer, obviously, both of those bills died, but the future of those bills is kind of being debated anew in this moment, in this climate. It is unclear, though, where we go from here on voting rights legislation, but has not quite yet died in Congress. But that remains to be seen.
Aaron is being nice about it. They're on life support. There's no plans of a filibuster carve out. There's no plan for President Joe Biden to barnstorm the country. Yes, he's busy. But if they don't pass voting rights legislation, it is, I mean, Frank, I want to understand what you think foreign leaders, not just their adversaries, but what is the line on the briefing paper for a foreign leader when they're coming to visit America? The state of American democracy is what?
Oh, unstable. Unstable. And you're right. It's not just our adversaries, because, you know, when our leaders travel, the Secretary of State, the President, the Vice President, the CIA Director, when they travel abroad, what do? They sometimes admonish even our allies. Hey, be careful with that human rights problem you're developing over here. Boy, we're really worried about this voting problem you have. Now that's happening with us, and foreign leaders are going to have to say, what's going on there? We're not that shining city on the hill that we've been. And you talk about make America great again. This strategy of undermining our faith and confidence in our three equal branches of government, with saying no to congressional subpoenas, with undermining faith and confidence in our election, that's not making America great again. And this fuels the foreign adversaries we have. If I'm the head of a foreign intelligence service right now, China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, I am now going to pump propaganda into the United States on social media more than we've ever seen, fueling this notion that you can't trust your elections. They're not right. even where Trump won, there were anomalies. You know, get the counties where Democrats vote the most, get them undermined. That's what we're ready for. And I hope Chris Krebs' successor is ready for that kind of flood of propaganda to jump on the back of what Trump's trying to do.
And I think Hillary Clinton commented, even with Facebook, it isn't even hard to do that. Frank Figluzzi, Aaron Haynes, thank you so much for starting us off. Charlie Sykes is sticking around. When we come back, as the GOP folds in the face of the disgraced ex-president's continued lies, our next guest, a lifelong Republican, argues there's only one way to save American democracy. Vote for the Democrats. That's next. Plus, Texas's near total ban on abortion back in effect, thanks to a decision by a federal appellate court. This was the worst case scenario. We'll look at the impact the GOP's war on reproductive liberties is having on women and people there. And how crazy have Republicans become in Texas? So cray-cray that a candidate for governor there felt compelled to rail against the COVID vaccine and vaccine mandates from his hospital bed as he was suffering from, wait for it, COVID. So then White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit msnbc.com/app to download.
This is not about ideology. This isn't about conservatism. This isn't about right versus left. This is about the kind of path of a personality cult. President Trump hasn't left the scene. He's still in the wings all the time, trying to orchestrate his return to power, or at least his kingmaker possibility here. There isn't really a political party anymore around him.
I love her. That was Dr. Fiona Hill on this broadcast last week, talking about the threat still posed today by the twice impeached, disgraced ex-president Donald Trump and the transformation of one of the country's two major political parties into what she describes as a cult of personality around the ex-president. It is a crisis that has a number of Republicans, not enough, but they're growing louder, urging those opposed to Trump to consider things that they might have thought unthinkable years ago. In an op-ed titled, quote, "We are Republicans with a plea. Elect Democrats in 2022. Our next guest writes this, quote, "Rational Republicans are losing the GOP civil war. And the only near-term way to battle pro-Trump extremists is for all of us to team up on key races and overarching political goals with our longtime political opponents, the Democratic Party." Joining us now, one of the authors of that piece, Miles Taylor, former chief of staff for the Department of Homeland Security, now the co-founder of the Republican Political Alliance for Integrity and Reform. Charlie's still here. Miles, I love you, brother, but I'm going to give it to you straight. The moment to do this was 2016, when some of us gladly, proudly voted for Hillary Clinton to stop this and didn't go serve in the administration and put a patina of all of your stature on him. What is the hope? What can you do now?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think what we showed in 2020, though, Nicole, is that this idea of coalition campaigning works. Is enough disaffected Republicans did in 2020 finally see the light and rally to kick Trump out of office. But it was only by very thin margins. And our worry here is if those disaffected Republicans stay out of the game in this next cycle, then pro-Trump extremists will win in these key races around the country. And that's what we're trying to avoid. So really what we're arguing here is to go after the folks, the radicals in the GOP, who are basically writing the party's eulogy right now, and to team up with Democrats to stop them. Now, for Republicans, that may mean foregoing a GOP candidate in certain races. For Democrats, it may mean a willingness to support a center-right independent against a Republican that they can't beat in places like deep red states. And so what we're doing this week at Renew America Movement is releasing a slate of those candidates, a slate of Democrats, independents, and a handful of courageous Republicans that should be defended. On the Democratic side, it's people like Alyssa Slotkin in Michigan and Abby Spanberger in Virginia that we're going to ask Republicans and urge Republicans to go out and support. And in other places, we're going to suggest that progressives, patriotic progressives, support folks like Evan McMullen, who's running as a center-right candidate against pro-Trump extremist Mike Lee in Utah. So that sort of coalition campaigning is what we're trying to do. And it did work to beat Donald Trump. And we've got to stick to that model in this next cycle.
And I hope it works, Miles. It's worked in other places. I wonder if you can tell me anything about the campaign strategy, how much money you have, will it include ads? Tell me what it looks like.
Yeah, well, look, right now we're trying to raise a war chest. I mean, we're trying to raise a $15 to $20 million war chest to target towards key congressional races. And these are races that I would call tip cases. It's not every race in the country. It's the races that we think can decide majorities in the House and in the Senate. Now, why is that important or significant for a group of Republicans to do? Is because what we're saying is Kevin McCarthy should not be the Speaker of the House of Representatives. If he is, it will become a haunted house. And that's one of the big things that we're trying to prevent. So we're playing in races where we think we can make that difference, primarily by supporting unifying centrist Democrats where it matters. And again, protecting that flank of Republicans who hopefully in the long run can reform the party. And if they don't, hopefully they'll be the ones to lead the charge for a new center right party in this country.
So hopefully one such kind of Republican is Adam Kinzinger. Let me show you his blast against his own party, Charlie, for refusing to just tell the truth.
Leaders have got to stand up and tell people the truth. So if you don't trust the media and you don't trust anything and you know you're inundated with sources of information, you're going to look at somebody that stands in front of you and talks. And if you trust them at heart, you're going to believe them. And when you have Steve Scalise say, not answer whether or not, you know, Joe Biden was legitimately elected, or you have, you know, Kevin McCarthy make it clear that Donald Trump caused January 6th and then put the paddles on him in Mar-a-Lago and resurrect him politically, it's no wonder 70% of the base believes the election was stolen. But let me say my biggest fear is that there's some people now that just don't simply care what the truth is, and that this idea of a stolen election is really just a cover, because this has now gone from let's go compete in the field of politics, we were convinced the election was stolen, to just simply, you know, power at all means. And if you're in the tribe, good, you're going to be in power, and that's what matters.
No matter how pathetic you are, Kevin McCarthy's sort of Trump lackiness included picking out his favorite Starburst flavors. And I think to Congressman Kinzinger's point, base politics are heading, are sort of taking the Republican Party down this path of it being all the things Miles says it is, you know, threat to the country, extreme, radical. And I think he's right. It's not just believing the lie. It's indifference to the truth that really endangers all of us.
No, and I think to comment on Adam Kinzinger, look, political courage is vanishingly rare in American politics, particularly among Republicans. So, you know, kudos to Adam Kinzinger, who continues to forcefully speak out. And he's absolutely right. I think there's been a very, very cynical calculation on the part of people like Kevin McCarthy that, you know, it's a midterm election. The Biden administration is struggling. His polls are down. We're going to sweep back into power. Let's keep our heads down. If that means accepting the big lie, well, then that's the price to get back into power. And I think that's what Republicans are telling themselves. Look, guys, we're going to win this election no matter what we do, no matter how reckless we are. So let's not mess it up. However, you would think that at some part, you know, there's some part of their souls where they look at Steve Scalise being so weaselly on television and comparing to Adam Kinzinger and say, who would you rather be? Would you rather be Adam Kinzinger or would you rather be a toady like Steve Scalise? Right now, the vast majority of Republicans are going the Steve Scalise model.
So sad. Miles, I'll give you the last word. Are you optimistic your effort will be successful?
I'm optimistic in the long run that there are forces for change in this country to make this happen. You just look at the polls. In fact, 50% of Americans now say that they are political independents. They're not Democrats or Republicans. Mm. So there's genuine consumer demand for something new in this country. In the short term, though, it's an uphill battle. I mean, that's the reason me and Governor Whitman led off the piece by saying rational Republicans are losing the GOP civil war. And so our last best hope at the moment is to team up with Democrats to deliver defeat to the radicals. That's what we've got to do now to win this fight. But look, I'm worried that American democracy won't reach its 300th birthday if we don't do this. So we really are calling on those concerned conservatives to join us. Come back into the fight. It's not over yet. And stay tuned.
Miles Taylor, thank you for spending some time with us. Charlie, sticking around. When we come back, how the on again, off again, now on again, near total ban on abortions is creating chaos and tragedy for women in Texas. That's next. Texas's near total ban on abortion is back in effect after a federal appeals court ordered it reinstated just 2 days after a lower court ruled it unconstitutional. A few brave doctors had resumed providing abortion care during the two-day suspension. They now face the threat of lawsuits. The law contains a provision that allows these doctors to be retroactively sued for abortions performed while it was injuncted. It's just one of the many court battles around reproductive rights, threatening the ability for women, not just in Texas, but all across this country, to access healthcare that is their right. Tomorrow, the United States Supreme Court will hear a case out of Kentucky that could functionally outlaw abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. Joining our conversation, Fatima Goss-Graves, president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center, and MSNBC medical contributor, Dr. Kavita Patel, former Obama White House health policy director. It's great to see both of you. Dr. Patel, I want to show you something that aired on the circus last night.
The first patient who I saw after the law went into effect, when I told her that we could see cardiac activity, you know, she just curled up into a ball on the table and just started sobbing. And she asked if she could hold my hand.
Yeah.
And that was all I could do for her in that moment. She was a college student, had a birth control failure. You know, she was a person who wasn't in a situation where she could be pregnant. Women in Texas have been punished legislative session after legislative session. These are people you know who are getting turned away, and this could be you next.
I wish I could play that every single day. That's what's happening.
Yeah, Nicole, look and think about just the anguish, not just that that poor woman is going through, but you heard it in kind of like the doctor's voice and the nurse's voices, any staff members' voices who are trying to balance what they can do legally. But you know, in their minds, they're thinking, because I've actually thought it myself, like, well, you know, do you really see heart activity? I don't know. Maybe we don't. And that's unacceptable. When we start to try to even wonder if we can blur any lines, of course we don't. Medicine tends to be, especially when arcane laws like this make everything that we do kind of on the line, but this is where we're at. And it's ironic, it's Indigenous Peoples Day. Indigenous persons, especially in the state of Texas, have always, decades, faced access issues, problems. And there was almost this like kind of whole woman's clinic, one of the clinics that actually resumed abortions and reproductive rights activity, reproductive access activities when there was the temporary block. It was one of the few clinics that's on the border in places where Indigenous women have had access to it. And to strip that away, I mean, what are we doing to women, to history, to families, and to the anguish and in a time of a pandemic? I mean, it's just utterly nonsensical.
And it's an important, you know, it's one woman's story. It's one woman's anguish, a college student who curled into a ball on the table and started sobbing and asked if she could hold my hand. But the reality, according to Axios, Fatima, is that large areas of the United States, particularly in the central region of the country, already have no options within a 250-mile drive. And some counties are at least 350 miles from the nearest abortion provider. West Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, North Dakota, and South Dakota all have large areas that are at least a four-hour drive from an abortion provider. This, as Dr. Patel said, is where we are and who we are.
You know, it's devastating and it's chaotic. We lost dozens of abortion providers in the South and in the Midwest in particular over the last decade, as there's been this acceleration of laws restricting access to abortion care. I think Texas is just making it so visible because it is so chaotic. And people woke up one day thinking they were going to be able to access abortion care, and then the next day found out they could not.
Dr. Patel, I want to turn to the Supreme Court. There's been a lot of reporting, a lot of great reporting about how agitated some of the justices are. Some of them have given speeches about being viewed as political. that seems to be maybe to be determined, I guess, by the outcome of some of these rulings. I want to read you some reporting in Vox. The Supreme Court takes a lie detector test. The court will hear a case Tuesday, Cameron versus EMW, Women's Surgical Center, which tests the hypothesis that the justices are, quote, always going to write to their personal preference in abortion cases. Cameron involves a Kentucky state law that restricts certain kinds of abortions, and it also involves an effort by Kentucky's Republican Attorney General, Daniel Cameron, to undo the pro-abortion work of his Democratic predecessor turned current Governor Andy Beshear. It is a classic partisan dispute over reproductive rights, with high officials from both parties maneuvering to get the policy outcome they prefer. The collateral damage is clear. It's women's lives. It's that college student's life. But the partisan nature of this shouldn't be overlooked either, because these are not policies. These are not abortion bans that poll well among Republicans. And I wonder, Dr. Patel, how to make sure the conversation stays clear. And to make clear, I mean, because it seems like the other side has used this sort of extremist disinformation around reproductive rights effectively. And that's part of how they, some of them got elected. But the extremists are in their own party. The extremists are the Republicans backing near total bans on abortion. And I wonder where you think the conversation should go. Dr. Patel first, and I'd like to hear from you too.
I think the conversation should go back to the facts on the ground. Just as you said, there are women that are hundreds of miles away from access, not just to abortions, Nicole. We've talked about how it's so important. These are women's health issues, and it's never just one thing. It's in those clinics, we're able to address depression. We're able to deal with the fact that that college student is likely not sleeping, no matter what the outcome of what happens to her. And so going back to the facts, how many women have been denied just basic health access, because it's not about abortions, just basic health access. Then to talk about maternal outcomes for women who are not able to access any sort of health services because of denial of their rights and just where they live. And then we have worse health outcomes. We actually have downstream health implications for everyone involved, even caregivers around that woman. So going back to the facts actually helps ground us. Actually, Justice Sotomayor kind of emphasized that in her remarks against kind of the shadow docket ruling. And I couldn't agree with her more. It wasn't partisan. She just simply kind of laid down, here's the law, and then here's really the medical repercussions. And that's where I fit in, because we have so many doctors and health providers who are actually trying to understand, where's our role in advocating for patients? I used to live in the state of Texas, and I will tell you that we did that all day, every day. And now I kind of think about this, I'm going to have to do that again, Nicole, because I think our whole country is going to have to be on the defensive around this, not just Texas or the 11 states that are trying to copy Texas.
Yeah, I mean, Fatima, I guess my question to you is the same that I asked Dr. Patel, but how does the awareness campaign and the effort to protect women's reproductive rights get scaled to 11 states or worse?
Part of it is making sure people understand that it's not even just these 11 states that are trying to pass copycat laws to the Texas law. It is the fact that other states will be next. There are more states that have what they call trigger laws, laws that basically say if Roe v. Wade is overturned, then abortion will be immediately banned in their state. And even the few states that are left, they will be inundated. We've already seen that with the state of Texas, as other states are taking in additional patients that they cannot serve. It won't just be chaotic. It will be sort of a state of lawlessness in and outside of the area of reproductive health. So we have to have this conversation again and again.
We will do just that. Fatima Gross-Graves, thank you for spending some time with us today. Dr. Patel sticks around. When we come back, the Republican candidate running for governor of Texas, who is blasting the COVID vaccine from his hospital bed where he is sick with COVID. That story's next.
When news breaks, go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app.
New developments in the legal drama surrounding former President Donald Trump.
Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows and hosts.
Lots of news of all kinds going on right now.
And the latest updates on the 2024 election.
The rematch is on. It's Trump-Biden Part 2.
Go beyond the what
to understand the why. Download the app now at msnbc.com/app.
For months now on this program, Texas has become the WTH, what the heck, state for news about voting rights, abortion rights, the war against COVID. And while Texas certainly has its cast of characters, I guess we'll call them out there, Greg Abbott, Dan Patrick, Ted Cruz come to mind, one Texas politician this weekend showed how crazy some fringe thinking in the Lone Star State has become. His name is Alan West, the former congressman from Florida who once called for the impeachment of President Barack Obama and now is challenging Greg Abbott for the GOP nomination for governor. He was hospitalized with COVID-19 this weekend after attending a crowded fundraiser. But it's his actions after being hospitalized that are getting some attention and coverage today. From his hospital bed, West, who is unvaccinated and has been a major opponent of coronavirus restrictions, launched a tweet storm in which he condemned vaccine mandates and promoted controversial treatments, including admitting that he has taken hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. I think that's the horse thing. We're back with Dr. Kavita Patel and Charlie Sykes. So first, let me say we wish Mr. West and his wife the best. We hope they get better from COVID. But I do want to read some of the news coverage from Texas to you first, Charlie. This is in the Washington Post. West has said that he and his wife, Angela, who's vaccinated, have received treatment with monoclonal antibodies, a move that a number of people argued on social media was at odds with his remarks against vaccines. Because of vaccines, he said they are, quote, enriching the pockets of Big Pharma. Monoclonal antibodies are proteins created in the laboratory to mimic the human immune system. The Biden administration announced last month that it had reached an agreement to buy another 1.4 million doses of the only authorized antibodies from the pharmaceutical company Regeneron for $2.9 billion, or $2,100 per dose. The most expensive coronavirus vaccines are $20 each. So I'm not sure what, you know, again, I'm glad Mr. West is getting monoclonal antibodies if they make him better. But it's a window into how bogus all the attacks on coronavirus public health measures really are.
Yeah, I mean, we have to have good wishes for his recovery, but we have to comment on the stupid. I mean, he's bad at math and he's bad at medicine here. His position is not only reckless, it's the invincible, impermeable ignorance of the position, saying that I'm not going to take the vaccine. I'm going to take this other drug because I don't want to enrich Big Pharma, when the cost of the other drugs is exponentially greater than the vaccines. But also it's the recklessness of continuing to rail against the vaccines at a time when Americans are dying. And this is part of this death spiral of craziness, where people like Alan West, who, you know, should not be anywhere near a position of responsibility, was until recently the chairman of the Texas Republican Party. And, as a former congressman. And I have to say that of all the things that we've talked about, Nicole, this is the single most frustrating. The demagoguery, the misinformation, the dishonesty, the craziness about a public health measure that will save lives. And if people pay attention to people like Alan West, more people will get sick, more people will be in the hospital, and more people will die. And so of all the things we've talked about, of the politicization, of the dumbing down of American politics and American culture, this is the most unnecessary, this is the most indefensible, and this is the most frustrating.
It's also the most dangerous. I mean, unvaccinated people are the spreaders of COVID in their communities. It's still not legal for any child under 12 to be vaccinated. Dr. Patel, I wonder your thoughts about all of it, but also that he's taking hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. Is that a good thing?
No, I mean, look, I would love to have a lot more options for taking care of COVID. And ivermectin, as you mentioned, a parasite and animal drug, is not one of them. And hydroxychloroquine can actually cause so much harm that everybody studies, trials, and experts, including the FDA, have weighed in on it. I think two things were very just impressive to me, Nicole, between his monoclonal antibodies and all the useless treatments he's taken, combined with a hospitalization in a state that has just been literally beaten up with COVID hospitalizations. He has racked up over $100,000 in costs. Yeah. So to talk about like kind of Big Pharma and railing on that, and then thinking about the cost of just his irresponsibility alone is incredible. Not to mention, this is the same state where we had people waiting and dying, veterans, moms, dads, parents, brothers and sisters waiting for hospital beds, not for COVID, but for other things who couldn't get them. So just those two things. And then the third, it just finally kind of sealed for me, because this is out there, it's on Twitter. You can just see how insidious the lies are on social media and how there's just no counter to it. And it just becomes a social network effect in all of its truth. Because there are people that actually think that this is what you should be doing. And then they somehow have conflated that to the vaccine mandate, a policy. Science lies, and somehow that is all about Joe Biden. Somehow it's Joe Biden's fault that he has, you know, ended up, you know, in Big Pharma's pocket. I mean, it's just, it's stunning to me.
Oh, it's a great point, Dr. I mean, so, right. And you're right. We're sort of, you know, we hope he recovers, but his rhetoric is irresponsible and dangerous. But, right, the way this strain of Republican operates, it's Joe Biden's fault for trying to protect him from getting sick with COVID. But thank God for Joe Biden that he can take all the drugs that he's obviously ordered up. And Joe Biden tried to protect him from anything bad happening from the dewormer. So we wish you the best, Mr. West. Dr. Kavita Patel, Charlie Sykes, thank you so much for spending some time with us on the day's lunacy. Quick break for us. We'll be right back. Of all the thousands of ways the pandemic changed all of our lives, one that didn't go unnoticed, at least by parents and kids, was the inability to do anything normal around Halloween last year. Sure, Dr. Fauci has said that trick-or-treating was reasonably safe, but only with perhaps overly strict safety measures. Well, now, a year later, here's his Halloween advice.
You're outdoors for the most part, at least when my children were out there doing trick-or-treating. And enjoy it. It's a good time to reflect on why it's important to get vaccinated, but go out there and enjoy Halloween as well as the other holidays that will be coming up.
Rather refreshing guidance as cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are now on the decline, not to mention this time next year, many of our younger trick-or-treaters will be vaccinated as well. Here's hoping. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes during these extraordinary times. We're grateful.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.